You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
But please give a really warm Greenbelt welcome to Lucy Sixsmith.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for coming. It's a real honour to be here. As we've said, I'm sure many of you will have had some experiences of Soul Survivor or something similar. But I thought some people may have just come in with a friend. So I've tried to make the talk a bit of an overview. I hope if this is new to you, there will be something in it that's food for thought. If you have come in with thoughts, the Q&A can go in other directions with the caveats that we've said. So I'd like to start with the title of the book, When the Music Fades. Those words are the first four words of a worship song, which I expect many of you could start singing at the drop of a hat. Don't worry, we're not going to. And if you don't know the song, don't worry either, because I can explain the song by telling you the story behind the song. And I'd like to tell the story as we always used to hear it, and then we'll think about whether we might hear it now in a different way. In the year 1997, Soul Survivor was an evangelical summer festival for teenagers, which had been running at that point for 4 years. There was also a Soul Survivor church meeting regularly on Sunday mornings in Watford. The founder and leader of both the festival and the church was Mike Pilavarci. The worship leader and head musician was Matt Redman. And the story goes that in 1997, the regular Sunday morning worship at Soul Survivor had become somehow stale. Outwardly, everything seemed fine. The church looked successful, things were going smoothly, the musicians and the sound engineers were doing everything they needed to do. But the sung worship seemed kind of off in a way that Mike Pilavarci couldn't quite put his finger on. He watched the musicians playing, and he listened to the church singing, and he concluded that the congregation had become an audience. They were watching, assessing, admiring the worship times, rather than taking part. A bold experiment was needed. The church decided that they would worship on Sunday mornings with no band, no sound setup, and no music. They would meet in silence, unless someone started up a song spontaneously. According to the story, the shift was awkward at first, but soon the church was worshipping with a new awareness of God and a new honesty, finding a way to worship in spirit and in truth without the physical paraphernalia of modern charismatic worship music. Then, once the focus was all on Jesus, the musicians came back. And out of that experience, Matt Redman wrote this song about what happens when the music fades. It's about coming before God in humility, with everything lost or laid down, and bringing a kind of worship which is deeper than singing. I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you. It's all about you, Jesus. Now, that story was told for years, and the song has been sung by thousands and thousands of people as a story and a song, supposedly about what really matters when a worshipper stands before God. I think the song works partly because it has quite a singable tune. It's easy for a congregation to pick up. I think there's something about the simplicity of an invitation just to Jesus, which means people feel that they can set aside all the complexity of their lives and find some kind of freedom in focusing only on him. And I think that for some people, the song must have worked because church does seem complicated. If your church looks a bit like a rock concert and you worry that it's all too showy, maybe it's all emotional hype rather than something real, then a song about coming back and finding that it's all about Jesus might seem like exactly the right thing. For a long time, I would have said that in a world of Christian celebrities and big shiny megachurches, Soul Survivor pretty much had its feet on the ground. I'd never been part of Soul Survivor Church, but I attended the festivals, I sang the songs, I read the books, and even when I started asking questions about churches, I kind of thought Soul Survivor seemed fine. In today's weather, I was reminded of a time at Soul Survivor when a seam in the roof of the big top split during an evening meeting and a swathe of rainwater took out the sound equipment. And for a short time, there was nothing coming over the PA system, and yet the crowd carried on singing a worship song. And the crowd singing did sound beautiful. And I think I'd been trained to think that that was pure worship, that it proved the honesty and depth of our worship if we did it without the music team, without the microphones and the sound equipment, and without the band. But there's another way of thinking about a church music team who stopped playing and a congregation who met in silence. In 1997, Matt Redman was the junior colleague. He had once been a teenager in the youth group while Mike Pilavarci was the youth worker. So when Mike Pilavarci proposed the radical experiment of banning the band, I think it would be hard for Matt Redman not to feel that he must be getting something wrong. I think it would be hard for the other musicians and sound engineers not to feel that they must be getting something wrong. I would certainly think I was doing badly if my line manager told me to stop doing the basic elements of my job description. But for ages, I never thought about the story or the song in that way. I didn't notice the power dynamics, because it was a standing joke that everyone at Soul Survivor was really just muddling along. When Mike told the story, in this book, for example, he said that at first he couldn't work out what the problem was, because after all, many of the musicians had worked out how to tune their instruments and the sound engineers were getting out of bed on time. So he asked himself, was it Redman's fault? And he listened. But Matt Redman wasn't singing any more duff notes than usual. I'm genuinely sorry to platform a Mike Pilavarci joke, but I do think it's important to see how the Soul Survivor mythology was constructed. The whole history and stature of Soul Survivor relied on that kind of self-deprecating humour, except that self-deprecating is the wrong word because the joke is entirely at the expense of Matt Redman and his team of musicians and sound engineers. If you were Matt Redman, and you heard Mike say, was it Redman's fault? Wouldn't you be thinking on some level that maybe it was? But I think a lot of us accepted the story because we just assumed that everyone at Soul Survivor was basically good friends. And perhaps we wanted to be part of things, joining in the fun in that parasocial way where you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. When Matt Redman told the story, here for example, he said this. Mike decided on a pretty drastic course of action. We'd strip everything away for a season, just to see where our hearts were. If I'm honest, I was pretty offended by the whole thing. The worship was my job. But as God softened my heart, I started to see his wisdom all over these actions. Stripping everything away, we slowly started to rediscover the heart of worship. That was Matt Redman's version. I now think the whole situation sounds ever so much like a punishment. As far as I know, Mike Pilavarci never had to stop preaching for a season, but the music team did have to stop playing music for a season. It's ironic that out of this period of not singing, Matt Redman wrote an exceptionally useful and popular worship song. But in the Soul Survivor theology of worship, you can't feel proud of yourself for writing a really good song, because the song itself has you saying, I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it. In the song, Matt Redman finds the problem in himself, whereas Mike Pilavarci had looked across the congregation and found the problem in everyone else. Mike's line on worship was that it's for the audience of one, capital O, it's all for God, it's only for God. And yet, he made himself an audience and assessor of the church's worship, all one of him. One paragraph, which is a little heavy. In April 2023, Mike Pilavarci stepped back from his role as associate pastor of Soul Survivor Watford. On Palm Sunday that year, the trustees told the congregation that the Church of England's national safeguarding team were investigating safeguarding concerns relating to Mike. Details began to emerge in the press as Mike's protégés and colleagues shared their stories. In September, the national safeguarding team said that safeguarding concerns were substantiated. A year later, an independent review confirmed the pattern of abuse, and further testimonies have been gathered by academics at the University of Durham, as well as by journalists and others. We now know that over the 40 years of his ministry, Mike Pilavarci repeatedly developed inappropriately close relationships with young men, promising them success in church leadership, picking up favourites and dropping them again. For many of those young men, working with Mike meant taking part in a routine of wrestling with him and also private massages to which they were made to feel they could not say no. Both men and women involved with Soul Survivor reported that Mike had a habit of emotional manipulation and controlling behaviour. Mike Pilavarci is no longer in ministry, his MBE was revoked, and so was the award he received from Lambeth Palace for, quote, outstanding contributions to evangelism and discipleship amongst young people, close quote. Those revelations in 2023 made me think differently about Matt Redman's song about what happens when the music fades. In fact, there were a lot of worship songs that I started to hear differently. I started to think about how many songs I knew about humility or surrender or laying everything down. Not all of them were written by Soul Survivor musicians. There is, after all, a very long tradition in Christian theology of things like kneeling or taking up your cross. But there were a lot of songs in the Soul Survivor songbooks written by those young men who worked with Mike Pilavarci that said things like, I'm humbled by your mercy and I'm broken inside. I lift you high and bow down low. Now I see what you command to be faithful and humble, putting selfish hopes aside. I'll become even more undignified than this. What good is it to gain the whole world but lose your soul? What good is it to make a sweet sound but remain proud? Now you might be noticing the biblical echoes in some of those lines, but I found I couldn't hear them in any straightforwardly theological sense. Not once I knew that the songwriters were more humiliated than humble. Not choosing a lower way freely, but coerced into it by a man who was supposed to be their mentor. Being humble or lowly or undignified might or might not be a sound theological choice. But in any case, it seems to me that humility can be forced upon someone rather than being a choice at all. At Soul Survivor, the practice of humility before God in worship had become tangled with the bullying and abuse of the people who wrote those songs we all sang again and again to worship God. I think for many of us, it was unsettling to realise that our theology was part and parcel with the abuse. That we weren't just questioning Mike Pilavarci's leadership or Soul Survivor as an organisation, but that the practice and language of worship itself had to be reassessed. So on the one hand, it's a problem when humility is forced on someone or used coercively to take their agency away. But on the other hand, it's also a problem when the idea of humility is used as a weapon. And I think that was the two-edged sword, if you like, of the Soul Survivor story. There was a kind of humility that was required of Mike's junior colleagues, but also, as I see it now, a kind of humility that I think he performed because it protected his status and contributed to his success. That made the Soul Survivor news a little different, I think, to many stories of leaders who fall. When the story was first reported, I remember there was a lot of conversation around Christian celebrity culture, about the ways in which Mike Pilavachi had been placed on a pedestal and looked up to as a Christian leader, almost a kind of visionary or prophet. And that was all true. A lot of people did look to Mike as someone who could hear God on their behalf. And Soul Survivor's success did rest partly on a cult of personality that surrounded Mike Pilavachi. But it seemed to me that that conversation about Christian celebrity didn't quite get to the heart of what happens with Soul Survivor. Because Mike had created this atmosphere where it felt like a tent of thousands of teenagers was just one big youth group, with Mike as the jovial youth worker affectionately overseeing it all. For many of us who were in the crowd, it really wasn't obvious that Mike was a Christian celebrity. He'd built an image that seemed so humble, we didn't notice how much power and influence he actually held. And he built for Soul Survivor a mythology which claimed that the whole organisation was basically cobbled together with faith and sellotape, and it only kept going because it was God's idea, we thought. So we didn't notice that we were looking to Soul Survivor as a model for how to worship and how to do youth ministry. We didn't, a lot of us, stop to ask whether faith and sellotape were really holding things together very well. So this wasn't just a story about one public hero who turned out to have feet of clay. By saying that, I want to be clear, I don't want to minimise survivors' experiences. In one sense, this is absolutely a story about a betrayal of trust by Mike Pilavachi. But it's also about structures of accountability and the actions that should have been taken or could be taken in future to prevent this happening again. And at the same time, I think there are these more general questions about culture and theology and how we worship and whether those things made it easier for the abuse to happen. The whole situation couldn't be resolved by just shuffling Mike Pilavachi off stage and then carrying on as we were. There were questions that I think needed to be asked. Questions that still go round in my head when I think about Soul Survivor. And even as I was planning this talk, I thought it still feels like a bit of a mess in my head. So in a slightly flippant way, I've tried to cram all my questions into 3 points that all begin with the same letter. I am so relieved I got a laugh for that. I thought you would look at me blankly. I've got 3 points that begin with the letter C to prove I'm still an evangelical at heart. Point one is about cost. I would still like to know how much was given up or given away by young people at Soul Survivor or in similar spaces because they thought they were surrendering themselves to God, but in fact they were also surrendering themselves to a human organisation and a human culture. I think some people probably look back on Soul Survivor quite neutrally. They remember silly jokes and the skate park and staying up late with their friends, and maybe they didn't take the spiritual side of things very seriously. I think some people might still say that good things came out of those teenage experiences. Maybe they met friends or their partner or chose a career, or maybe they still feel it was the Holy Spirit they encountered in that big tent on Bath and West Showground. But I wonder about the people who look back and feel that they sacrificed something of themselves to this way of doing faith. What might be the lost opportunities if you surrender your life to be part of God's big story before you've learned how to do really basic things like apply for a job or navigate your friendships or make your own decisions about what you value and care about? What sense of agency are you handing over if you're always trying to work out what God's amazing plan is rather than taking responsibility for your own perfectly average and human plan? What am I giving up if I let the leaders on stage guide my impressions of what God's presence is? It seems to me now that it might be inherently manipulative to use your voice, as Mike Pilavachi did, to create for an entire tent of thousands of people the impression that God is present and bringing healing and doing wonderful things, as people say. It seems to me that it might be a cruel thing to let people think they've encountered God and let them cry and laugh and shake and be overcome by the emotion of it all, if they're going to walk away and later think maybe it wasn't God. Maybe that wasn't the work of a loving creator, but a human artifact brought about by playing the audience with natural human skill. I worry about the effect of feeling misled about something as deep and all-encompassing as the nature and presence of God. And I worry about whether that openness to God, which was always so deliberately encouraged in charismatic spaces, might make people more vulnerable to serious abuse. Because if we're saying, be open, receive, don't be skeptical, don't be critical, be expectant, if we say all that, then maybe we're not saying that people are allowed to have boundaries, or that anyone who crosses boundaries will be held accountable. If we're saying that God is at work here, then maybe we're inviting people to let their guard down, maybe even switch off their normal intuitions about what feels right and safe. If we're saying it's good to be even more undignified than this, we might be forgetting to say that human dignity is actually really important. I think dignity is a good thing. I'm quite keen on dignity for the people I care about and people I work with and people in general. And I think maybe in churches and religious organisations, we should be saying that you're entitled to have your dignity protected and that our spaces and structures will value your dignity above our organisation's success. So point one was cost. Point two is complicity. And that word might be too strong, but it begins with a C, so we're sticking with it. I think if you're in the crowd at a place like Soul Survivor, there's a risk that whoever has the microphone will have too much power over what you're thinking and feeling and what you come to believe. That's the cost. But I think at Soul Survivor, there was also a risk of coming away with an exaggerated sense of power in oneself. If you're told that you're filled with the Spirit and that the Spirit's work is to heal people and bring them to Jesus and do miracles and who knows, maybe start a nationwide revival. And again, that's the Spirit that lives in you. If any version of that gets in your head, I think it will create either this extraordinary kind of overconfidence or a burden of eternal responsibility. The sense of being on a mission empowered by the Spirit might feel absolutely wonderful, but it's also an enormous pressure if you think you're supposed to save the world. I don't think every Soul Survivor kid literally thought they were supposed to start a nationwide revival. But they were encouraged to take their new enthusiasm back to their home churches as if they, as the kids, must know something now that the ordinary, boring grown-ups who had never been to Soul Survivor had no access to. those kids might also have felt inspired to tell their friends about Jesus. They might have gone back to their classrooms and school playing fields with this immense sense of being right, which I think can come naturally to teenagers, but isn't necessarily useful to them. It also seems not quite fair to the other kids in the class when their friends come back from Soul Survivor full of faith and eager to tell them that all their beliefs are wrong. I worry that if you're too sure that the Holy Spirit is working, then the narcissism of the leaders might also develop a kind of narcissism in the crowds. We all think we know the correct answer, or if we don't know the answer, at least we all know what the correct questions are. It's a little harder to challenge the status of the leaders or assess the overall health of our culture if we're getting a sense of satisfaction from being part of the tribe. Despite all that about humility and surrender, I think for me at least, there was a kind of arrogance that came with being part of the right tribe. So point one was cost, point two was complicity, and point three is coming back, or not coming back, to the heart of worship. I think in evangelical thinking, there was always a kind of pattern where if anything seemed complicated, you were meant to circle back to your starting point. It was normal to have questions or to get confused by things or have difficult experiences. But there was always this assumption that somehow you'd find a way to get back to basics, to come back to the cross, back to Jesus's feet, back to his goodness, back to the bit that really matters. And perhaps sometimes it is possible to hear of an abusive leader or a safeguarding crisis and feel all the anger and sadness that comes with that, and nonetheless circle back to something that's solid, that you can rely on while you're angry. I can absolutely see the usefulness of that as a habitual movement. It just gets awkward if your usual practice of coming back to the heart of worship is itself part of the culture and theology that now seems untrustworthy. If I suspect that some notion of surrendering to God has made people vulnerable, I can't surrender to God all over again in the same way to find a fresh starting point. It's not obvious how to come back to the heart of worship if it seems like coming back to the heart of worship was itself a manipulative trick. Psalm 11 verse 3, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? I think some people, instead of circling back, find a way of moving forward. And of course, different people find different paths. There are people who were hurt at Soul Survivor and in similar spaces and stayed in charismatic evangelical churches, just as there are some who left church and will never go near one again. There are people who have ended up in other church traditions and people who have found something somewhat like church in some other kind of community or way of thinking or way of being. And then there are some of us who think that there might not be an alternative or an answer to all these questions. Because if I did work out an alternative or an answer, even just for myself, that might feel like I'm acting like I'm right all over again. And I can't be certain of being right now, when I think I shouldn't have been so very, very certain of being right before. I can't jump with both feet into an answer just to feel like I have an answer. And in any case, I wanted to write a book about all of this that would welcome readers from every different situation, who were all gathered in that one big tent back then, but who might be all over the place now. I wasn't sure how it would feel, after writing a book about being at a summer festival, to come to a different summer festival and stand in front of this microphone. In the book, I imagined myself always in the crowd, and now it's like, what? I worried about doing this talk. Because in a book, you can leave more space for everyone to remember things differently and to think about things differently. You can mark that as you write. I hoped readers would follow their own thought processes and even just put the book down if actually it wasn't helping. Because one of the great things about books is that you can stop reading them. You can skim read, you can skip to the end, and what happens in your head may be the more important thing. This talk feels like a more demanding claim on your time. I'm acting like my words are kind of worth your attention. And that seems to me a bold thing to assume, since I also think your attention is among the most valuable and generous of gifts. I once knew a teacher trainer who said that it's strange in English how we talk about paying attention to someone or giving our attention to someone, as if our attention is this object we can hold in our hands and offer to someone. I think to some extent, the people who have the microphones have power because they have our attention. And it isn't always wrong to make that payment or gift. I think a lot of preachers really would have liked to be stand-up comedians. And in something like comedy, everyone can see that it's a knack or a skill with words and delivery that elicits a reaction from the crowd. It's a fair exchange if a comedian makes you laugh. Giving our attention is less costly to us when we know we're watching a performance. But when the performance becomes deceitful, I think the cost can be too great. So if there's one thing I want to say in this moment while I have this microphone, it's this. When anything more serious than stand-up comedy is at stake, remember how valuable your attention is. In any crowd, each individual person has their own story and their own perspective. And although I use the phrase soul survivor generation in the title of my book, in my head, I always had imaginary quote marks around the word generation. Because when we talk about generations, like it's just this big blob, somehow the whole is less than the sum of its parts. We talk about the uniform blob, and what I care about is all the individual people giving up their attention. And the risk that if they give up their attention, maybe they'll also give up their time and their money and their skills and their dignity and their personhood and their own needs in the service of someone else's vision. And we need to know if it's a fair trade. We need to know whether or not the vision was worthwhile and whether the payment that was required was really just. If someone graciously gives us their attention, we should keep in mind how much it might cost them. If someone claims our attention, we should make sure our gift is right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lucy. So much to think about and reflect on and unpick there. And as we said at the beginning, if things have arisen in this time, we have got Festival Wellbeing available. They're wandering around the back in blue hi-vis. So please, please, please seek any support or chat or time that you need from them. They're very, very happy to speak with you. We're going to have an opportunity now for some questions. As I said at the beginning, if we could keep it to questions, we know there's a lot that all of us could kind of have of this conversation. And there will be other opportunities in the Jesus Arms or at your campsites or with friends to do that and to share those stories, or with Festival Wellbeing if that's what you need. But if you have a question, maybe something that you want Lucy to unpick a little bit more or that kind of wasn't touched on, maybe you've read the book and want to ask a question based on something else that's in there, if you could put your hand up clearly in the air and I will come round with a radio mic. This talk is being recorded, so if you don't want your voice to be on the recording, that's absolutely fine. Let me know and I can say your question into the microphone for you. Just give me a wave of that when I come to you. And I will try and make sure that we kind of get from a range of people and a range of voices and a range of sides of the tent. So bear with me while I get my steps in going across. So if we start, there's a question just down here. Is this? Yeah, there we go.
Thank you. Thank you, Lucy. I was in the table tent not so long ago, and it was announced that some of our friends at the big Churched Out festival have suffered injuries due to falling signage. And I have a friend I've just messaged and waited to hear back from. I think it's very important that you'd feel welcome to deliver this exact same message at that festival. What are your sort of thoughts and feelings about that and that space?
Thank you.
I think when I was writing the book, I didn't know whether anyone would want me to talk about it. So each time there's been some opportunity, I'm thrilled that you're all here. Like, it felt like me at my computer in my room. I kept forgetting that anyone was actually going to read it, to be honest. I hoped that I would have opportunities. I had to kind of plan in my mind that I would say yes to whatever came up, because all of them are quite nerve-wracking. So if it was something that I hadn't maybe heard of what it was, I'd say yes. If it was something that seemed a bit more scary to me, hypothetically something could come up that I wouldn't feel comfortable with, I guess, but... I don't know. I'm sure there would be circumstances where it would be right to say, I'm sorry, I'm busy, I have work to do. But on principle, I've tried to say yes to conversations.
Thank you so much for sharing. I have a question in terms of those who are preaching. By the way, I don't like the word preaching. Oh, because it feels like someone is looking down. I'd like to use the word talk. Mm-hmm. So those of us who give talks, how do you honour people's attention? How do you honour their vulnerability? How do you honour what they are bringing into the room, as well as you bring your own vulnerability into the room without falling into complacency? Does that make sense?
Yeah, great question. And I guess also not wanting things to become vulnerable beyond what people... wants. I mean, that's the often that was one of the things I wanted to think about charismatic practice, was that there was quite a lot of encouragement to be vulnerable in ministry times. I think how one manages a situation like this, where I talk to you for half an hour, I mean, I don't know what one does with that. I'm hugely grateful that you all came. Maybe it's just being aware that there's an awful lot to think about there. I can imagine that often talks are being prepared by busy people who have to get it done on a Saturday afternoon, so it's ready on Sunday. And that's just how life works. But perhaps finding spaces to step back and say, what is this? What kind of diversity of forms are there, rather than assuming that we know what a preach or a talk or a sermon or a homily or so on and so on and so on. I'm finding myself thinking about like my other life in English Lit in universities, like thinking about how words work and how they do things between people. Is very, very complicated, but interesting to think about. So maybe that could be made into a positive thing of there's lots of complexity here, but if we think about it as complication is fun, we can talk about it. Maybe that's where we could talk about it without just kind of burdening speakers too much. Maybe. I'm thinking aloud. Thank you for the question. Yeah, sorry, can't tell where you are. Yeah, so the question was about the although Soul Survivor has finished, I guess, the alternatives that are still going, and the sense that there isn't any other formats for evangelical young people, and that these festivals are still really popular. I think I would want to be careful what I say about those festivals now, because I don't really know. I haven't been involved in anything like that myself, and I was kind of going back in my head to 2006. So I don't want to assume that things aren't being discussed behind the scenes of those festivals, and it could be that I wouldn't be surprised if there are people thinking carefully about it who are, you know, small people rather than people who get heard, I guess. So I don't really know. That's not a great answer, I know. I hope there are conversations happening everywhere. So.
Oh, it's not working. Yeah, it is working. It's coming and going, so I'll try. Mm. I recognise the pattern of manipulation in what you're saying, but also a lot of people's faith was damaged when what was going on behind the scenes came out. Do you think it possible that actually a lot of what the Holy Spirit was doing was genuine, despite what God knew about the people in leadership that we don't yet, that God was able to work in that situation despite the flaws of the people who were running it?
Yeah, I think certainly at the time when it was kind of big news, as from the point of view of someone processing it all, it felt like a lot of people were quite quick to say, of course God was doing wonderful things. When if you're in the middle of processing, it's not obvious at all, either way. So because I was hearing people saying, obviously all of the God stuff was God and there was stuff happening off stage, I wanted to correct that perspective, I suppose. I think also, I wouldn't want to get into an example and I can't think of one, but there are situations where genuinely everything public looks healthy and something private is not so great. I guess I wanted to think about whether what was happening in public in some ways follows the same pattern more weakly than to what's going on behind the scenes. So I guess the most obvious example is that prayer ministry times at Soul Survivor were always led by Mike Pilavachi. And the Scolding and Philbrook report made a point of saying he always led those sessions. It was always Mike who said, let's wait for the Holy Spirit to come. And it was discussed as a workplace issue if he wasn't kind of bringing other leaders forward. And they specifically said, we're not here to question charismatic practice. They were lawyers. And I thought, well, as I've grown up charismatic, I do want to question charismatic practice. And if we're hearing that Mike had a sort of coercive, manipulative style as a boss or as a colleague, if it was always him who was on the mic, it feels like those things were made to happen. And I've found that if I describe it to someone who wasn't there, to family members, they kind of go, what? It was like that. It sounds shocking to people who weren't there. That's a very long answer. And of course, if someone has that memory of God having done something good, I'm not about to take that away. But it's not just we found out something bad. Oh no, we must throw everything away. It's also that there are some similarities between the new things we learned and the stuff that we were always aware of. Does that make sense?
A huge thank you for talking about Soul Survivor and similar, because I think for many of us, Soul Survivor affected the whole national landscape of charismatic worship with young people. That's the past. My question's about the future. I wonder what you think the key lessons for leadership are from what you've researched, written, experienced that we can take away.
That's a really great question. I wish I had a really good answer. I think I would feel like I was kind of going above my pay grade if I said anything definitive. I think I was very much writing the book in the... I was thinking recently it was kind of a lockdown book, even though it was a little bit after COVID lockdowns. It was very much like, gosh, I'm in my house. I'm thinking about all of this. It's all going on in my head. And I wanted it to be space for others to sort of join in that if they didn't have anywhere else to go. So maybe the message for people who are in leadership is that they're also allowed to take space to actually really think. And we don't need them to kind of keep a brave face on and act like everything's fine. It might be richer and more beneficial for the whole church if we heard a bit more of this is going to take some time, or this is really confusing and we're thinking about it. That's maybe what I would want to be offering, is that, yeah, take that space. That doesn't feel like quite an answer. Thank you for the question.
Hello. Thank you so much for bringing this to Greenbelt. Thinking about our learnings from Soul Survivor, but also other churches like this in the UK and overseas with really powerful kind of celebrity leaders, do you think that there's something inherently problematic about charismatic or evangelical worship as a kind of, as an idea? And your personal view as someone who has that background and has spent lots of time researching this.
Such a hard question. Really important question. I think I wanted to think about it because I wanted to work that question out. Like, that's probably the heart of it. And I remember saying to someone once, like, about this thing about we can't just talk about safeguarding as governance and processes. It needs to also be the theology and the practice of being charismatic. And my friend said, but who would do that kind of work? Because the people who are in the charismatic church are going to be biased and you know, feel mixed up about it. But the people who are outside the charismatic church and always hated it are not very well placed to do that work either. So how do we find a way to think about it? Maybe we can't find a completely impartial, disinterested way. If I try to think about charismatic faith, that's my entire life. Like, I grew up in it. This has always been me. I don't think I can suddenly become something else. But for that reason, I want to think about it. Maybe we need to get the people who hate it and the people who loved it and like all of them come together. But that would be such an impossible conversation. It's your mission should you choose to accept it. Thank you for asking it. It's important.
Thank you. We probably have time for a couple more. Anybody?
Thank you. Lucy, thank you for the book. I read it. It's a fantastic, as a memoir. I think that's a great capture. And you also mentioned generation, and people have been asking about lessons and going forward. Back in the 80s, I was on the fringes of something called the 9 o'clock service in Sheffield as a local expression. And, you know, the lessons were never learnt. And the Church of England in particular looks to the goose that lays the golden eggs. And it indulged Soul Survivor as far as I could see. My question really is to say, is there plans for further work to place your memoir alongside others and perhaps to incorporate, as the gentleman said over there, the multitude of other Christian festivals that are still within that genre? And they're not safe places. We're, a lot of us here in Greenbelt are out the other side, a generation down, wrestling with these things.
One decision I had to make when I was drafting material for the book was to focus on Soul Survivor, because I was, you know, reading, listening to podcasts. I was aware of all sorts of other churches' stories around the world, you know, recently and some time ago. And I had to decide to just have Soul Survivor. Otherwise, it was just going to get way too complicated. But all of those other things, and it will be different situations for different people, are kind of all there as well. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what the question was in saying that. Within the bigger, yeah, just a sense of there's so much. And it's interesting whether it's a memoir or not. We used the word memoir in the blurb and then changed it because it kind of is and it kind of isn't. So in case anyone hasn't read it yet, it's worth knowing that there's quite a lot of me saying, I remember it like this, this is a memory I have, this is an experience. Not because it's a story of my life so much as I don't want to be speaking for everyone else. And there's what I remember, and there's what every other single person, everyone in the crowd has their own, I remember this, I experienced this. And there's a kind of almost trying to include more people by saying, well, this was just my perspective. So yeah, if you like memoir, then maybe you'll like it. But if you don't like memoir, it is a bit of a mixture. And if you like things that are a bit of a mixture, you might like it.
Was there a hand up over here a minute ago? Yeah.
Thank you very much for what you've shared. yeah, I'm hiding. Coming back to the heart of worship, you talked a lot about the songs and where they've kind of come from. Do you think we should be abandoning singing those things because of their history and what they might have come out of? Or do you think that they still have value?
I'm going to have to answer from the microphone. Sorry, I'll lean round. I wouldn't want to be absolutist about what people should and shouldn't do, I think. It's all much more coming from what seemed feasible to me at the time. Which was almost a kind of I was envious of everyone who was singing the songs and not thinking about Soul Survivor. You know, if you didn't know who the songwriter was and it connects with something you're feeling at the time, and you know, these song lyrics are flexible enough that two people can be standing next to each other meaning slightly different things. So I don't think worship lyrics are kind of black and white, like this song is evil and this song is fine. It's again a bit like the preachers could be talking about it and it would be an interesting discussion. We could talk about the content of our song lyrics. And that would be fun. Like, at the point when I was going to Hillsong Church in Moscow, I said to my friend, I don't like this song. I don't think it makes sense. Theology's terrible. And she said, but they're all checked by a particular senior pastor in Sydney who knows theology really well. I'm allowed to talk about it. So I think my answer would be, let's have fun talking about the song lyrics. And that in itself wouldn't be worship, but we're allowed to do that.
Thank you. We do have time for one more, if I don't have to climb across the whole tent. Is there one?
Do we know if Mike Pilavachi was accountable to anybody? And if he had somebody to be accountable to, would it be a different story?
So the Scalding and Fulbright reports would be, I guess, the fullest account of the background at the moment. That would be a slightly different question at different stages, I guess, of whether you mean accountability when he was a trainee, a sort of a beginning youth worker, or later on when he's running this huge organisation. There are documents out there. It's sort of not my expertise, I think. But an important question. Thank you.
Thank you so much for a range of really interesting and thoughtful questions. Sorry to those of you that we didn't get to, but please do carry those conversations on over the weekend. A huge, huge thank you to Lucy for sharing with us.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.